The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 1st of July 2020 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Allianz.
As part of the programme's partnership with Allianz, we are bringing you stories that demonstrate Allianz's commitment to securing people's lives. After all, for 130 years all around the globe, Allianz has been working hard to do just that, to give courage to its customers for what's ahead. Because Allianz knows how important it is to have a fair partner at your side who provides solid and sustainable solutions. Allianz strives to do it right, with passion, every day. Stay tuned to The Briefing to hear exactly how Allianz does it. An Allianz for life.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up,
it affects new generation of Russians who want change, want something different, and who are fed up with the kind of Putin system. So they will suffer first and foremost, but also it means some of the crazy things the Kremlin has been doing with its spies in recent years, trying to hack and sabotage and subvert the West. All of that will continue.
On the day that Russians almost certainly vote to award Vladimir Putin an indefinite lease on the Kremlin, we'll hear from Luke Harding about what we're still learning about Russia's covert campaigning abroad. We'll also look at the medical and political reasons for the COVID-19 surge in the United States, as Americans are informed by the EU that they'll all be holidaying somewhere else this summer. We'll catch up with the latest business news and...
I'm Chiara Remella, Monocle's culture editor, and I'll be bringing you a roundup of the cultural news, including why New Zealand has a chance to strike it even bigger on the global film scene.
All that coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Russians are voting today on constitutional reforms, which, if enacted and to peer past the technical niceties, will effectively enable President Vladimir Putin to continue haunting the Kremlin for more or less as long as he pleases. At the same time, Russia is once again making headlines in the United States as more emerges about Russia's payment of bounties to Taliban guerrillas in Afghanistan upon the inflicting of American casualties and the degree to which US President Donald Trump knew about this or cared. Guardian journalist Luke Harding has been among the most dogged unravelers of the ties between Trump and Russia. His new book, Shadow State, Murder, Mayhem and Russia's Remaking of the West, is another bracing look at what Russia does and why Russia does it. I spoke to Luke earlier. I began by asking what's in today's vote for President Putin, whether he can't think of any agreeable retirement options or just doesn't trust anyone else to do the job.
I think it's that. I think it's the fact that he wants to kind of formalize his presidency for life. After this vote has happened, he can stay in power until 2036. So he's going to out-Stalin Stalin. He will be in the Kremlin until his 70s, possibly even his early 80s. And we'll clearly see off Donald Trump. Whatever happens in November, he'll see off Boris Johnson. And he's actually a dictator. I mean, that really is the word for it, because political opposition in Russia has been squashed, real opposition over the last two decades, quite systematically. First of all, it affects new generation of Russians who want change, want something different, and who are fed up with the kind of Putin system. So they will suffer first and foremost, but also it means some of the crazy things the Kremlin has been doing with its spies in recent years, trying to hack and sabotage and subvert the West. all of that will continue.
We'll talk a bit more about those shortly, because that's the ground very much covered in your new book, Shadow State. But the other Russia story doing the rounds at the moment, of course, is this story suggesting that Russia was offering Taliban factions a bounty to kill American troops in Afghanistan, with the sub-scandal to that that Donald Trump has known about this for some time, or was at least told about this some time ago, and has not reacted to it. The technique or the policy in itself, does that sound like something that Russia would actually involve itself in?
Absolutely. There's nothing new here. I mean, this is something that the Soviet Union did. This is something that Russia has been doing, most recently with the Novichok poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury in March 2018. Now, we think it's the same murder unit, the same secret unit belonging to the GRU, that's Russian military intelligence, behind both the hit against Skripal in Salisbury and against this sort of extraordinary alleged campaign in Afghanistan to pay a bounty to the Taliban to kill Americans. Now, I think what you have to understand is Putin's thinking, and Putin's thinking is classic KGB. He sees America, and also to some extent the UK, as the main enemy, and really sees Moscow as in a state of kind of semi-war with the West. So for him, it's fair game. He sees this as revenge for the Soviet humiliation in Afghanistan in the 1980s, when, of course, the Americans helped the Mujahideen and gave them sort of Stinger weapons, and for a series of sort of geopolitical grudges stretching through the 90s, the noughties, and so on. So this is absolutely something that Russian spies would do. Officially, they'll deny it, and I think these reports are very convincing.
We spoke, I think, back in 2017 about the predecessor volume to Shadow State, which was Collusion, subtitle Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Donald Trump Win. In the 3 years since, of course, we've had the Mueller report and other investigations, mostly by journalists. How much clearer has that picture become, the degree to which Donald Trump is actually on the hook to Russia?
I think astonishing. I mean, his defenders say nothing to see here, it's all a hoax, this is what Trump has been saying. But actually, if you take a step back from his chaotic and dysfunctional presidency, there's one clear and consistent theme, which is his slavish behaviour towards Vladimir Putin. There was a story yesterday by Carl Bernstein of CNN reporting on his Trump's calls to foreign leaders, where he's fawning towards Vladimir Putin and apparently demeaning towards Theresa May and Angela Merkel and so on. You have to ask yourself, and this is the question I posed in Collusion and I could come back to in Shadow State, why does Trump behave like this? And really, the most plausible explanation is the one given by Christopher Steele, the ex-MI6 spy who produced the famous dossier, which is the Russians have leverage over Trump. There may be financial connections. We don't know. We haven't seen his tax returns. But the whole question of compromise, I think, is there. And just one other thing on this is that I don't think when Trump and Putin meet and have these kind of private tete-a-tetes that it is Putin saying, you know, Donald, do what I tell you or we will embarrass and humiliate you and release awful compromising material. I think Putin treats Trump in the manner of a classic KGB officer, and it's flattery. He just plays him, plays to his psychological weakness, praises him, says, you know, I will be with you, Donald. You're beset by enemies and liberals and traitors, but I will be your loyal friend.
Your book lays out an astonishingly broad-ranging and audacious, even shameless, program of disruption, deception, and in the case of things like the Skripal poisoning, even worse. Where have you got to in terms of why Russia does any of this? Has Russia just locked itself in a pattern of behavior that it no longer knows how to get out of? Are they just doing this stuff for the sake of doing this stuff?
I think it's opportunism. And more than that, what's so fascinating, what I try and explore in Shadow State, is that Putin is doing what the KGB has always done, which is to seek to divide the West, to sniff out weakness, to exploit divisions in British society, American society, European politics, and so on. But he's doing it with a kind of verve and reach that the KGB didn't have. And so it's the old Soviet playbook of active measures of disruption and diversion, but updated, shined up for our era of Facebook and Twitter and social media. So back in 2016, we saw Troll Factory in St. Petersburg. We saw Russians sitting behind their keyboards pretending to be Americans, playing with the heads of US voters. But we also see these kind of old school, brutal, exotic murders, like we had with Alexander Litvinenko in 2006, poison with radioactive tea in London, and also with the hit on Skripal. And so it's this mixture of old and new. And Putin's goal, he doesn't believe in mutual solutions. He thinks what is bad for the West is good for Russia. So he is trying to do everything he can to undermine Western democracies. And with Trump, I think he's hit the jackpot. He has a candidate who, without much pushing, really is turning America into almost a kind of corrupt pastiche of itself. And I think geopolitically, it's going very well for him.
The difficulty is in responding to that if you are a Western nation which is minded to respond to that, so that probably rules the United States out at the moment, is what options do you have from confronting what is by now all but a rogue state, at least as your book characterizes it? I mean, we've talked about the Skripal poisoning in this interview, which was, you know, about as outrageous as behaviour like that can possibly get. This is distributing a nerve agent among a civilian population, which could have had much worse consequences. Would it have caused Russia to adjust its behaviour in the slightest if, for example, the United Kingdom had reacted to that by just saying, OK, we are done. Take all your embassies and all your consulates, pack them up and get them out of here. We no longer have any sort of relationship at all.
Yeah, I mean, Andrew, it's a great question. And this has been the problem all the way through, is that Putin has done one rogue deed after another. He's invaded Georgia, he's bitten off Crimea and annexed it, he's fomented a war in eastern Ukraine and changed Europe's borders the first time since 1945, you know, plus Skripal, plus Litvinenko, plus the US election and so on. And what he does is he does these things and the West is kind of wrong-footed and responds conventionally. Words of condemnation, few diplomats thrown out. And then he keeps going. There's this sort of trajectory, which I try and explore in my book, of emboldenment because of a weak response. Now, there are smart things the UK in particular could do. And one weakness of this regime is that at home, they are super patriots. They love Putin. They sort of praise his foreign policy and so on. But actually, they're pretty kind of cynical about the real state of Russia, and all of their money, and quite often their families, are in the West. They're in London, they're in New York or in Paris and so on, and their assets are very often hidden in British tax havens. Now, what a kind of robust British government could do is go after this cash, sanction individuals, ban them from travelling, say to 5,000 top Kremlin people, OK, you're not coming to the party anymore. The problem actually is that this government of Boris Johnson, I think, has got no appetite for that because it's worried post-Brexit about inward investment and thinks Russian cash, maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Luke Harding, thank you for joining us.
That was Luke speaking to me earlier. His new book, Shadow State, is published by Faber and Faber. It is out now. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. This is The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller, and however rough a day you're having at work, at least you're not trying to be a voice of informed scientific reason in Donald Trump's White House.
I can't make an accurate prediction, but it is going to be very disturbing. I will guarantee you that, because when you have an outbreak in one part of the country, even though in other parts of the country they're doing well, they are vulnerable. I made that point very clearly last week at a press conference. We can't just focus on those areas that are having the surge. It puts the entire country at risk. We are now having 40-plus thousand new cases a day. I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around, and so I am very concerned.
Dr. Anthony Fauci there attempting to steer the current White House coronavirus task force and America with it away from the rocks. Fauci has once again warned that the US does not have COVID-19 anywhere near under control. Confirmed cases are currently clearing 40,000 a day, and 16 states have paused or reversed recent reopenings. Well, let's get more on this with Monocle 24's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith, and also Amy Pope, Associate Fellow at the US and Americas program at Chatham House. Amy worked very closely with Dr. Fauci when she was US Deputy Homeland Security Advisor. Chris, let's come to you first. How concerning is the surge in the United States? Is it over and above what should be expected by a country of its size?
Well, I mean, it's a very distressing situation, but it's very much predictable. And we're going to see lots and lots of this. And we need to prepare ourselves all around the world for this happening increasingly. in the near future. And this is not going to go away anytime soon. I was just on a call about half an hour ago to a gentleman in Australia, in Melbourne, who has seen a lockdown imposed again in Melbourne, in Australia, a country which was previously saluted as having dealt with coronavirus very well. They were straight out the blocks with testing at a very high level and have controlled the virus incredibly well. But even they've had problems, and now they've got a major city which has had chunks of itself shut down for the foreseeable month. So we're going to see this as the pattern going forward. But yes, the numbers in America are extremely high, and we're very concerned about that.
Amy, if we look at this surge in the United States, how much of this is not so much medical as political? I mean, how did we arrive at a point at which the fairly low stress, common sense precaution of wearing masks in public has become a culture war issue?
It's unusual, right? I mean, these recommendations are not political recommendations. Dr. Fauci is not a political actor. As you know, he's served multiple different administrations, Republican and Democrat alike. I have no idea what his politics are. So it's really troubling that right now the country has been divided around what are common sense health measures. And that's not really been helped, frankly, by President Trump. As you know, he's been agitating himself. He's basically encouraged people to protest the act of governors to keep people safe. He's encouraged people to protest against lockdowns, against the wearing of masks. He himself refuses to wear a mask. So it's a highly volatile situation that doesn't make a lot of common sense, but clearly the president sees it as a way to divide the population and create some support in advance of November and the elections in the U.S.
Amy, just to follow that up, because in nearly 4 years of this circus unfolding on Pennsylvania Avenue, we've started to internalize a lot of this kind of thing as normal. And it really, really isn't. And this, as you say, shouldn't be a partisan issue. So maybe for a benchmark, if you think back to the administration you worked in, for example, what would a, for want of a better word, normal administration be doing if confronted with a pandemic such as this one?
Well, first of all, you want to have a common protocol that is shared across all of the states and that is adopted and embraced by the White House. So it is true that CDC has put out protocols, for example, the Centers for Disease Control. It is true that Dr. Fauci has articulated many of these things. But if the president himself is not embracing them, it's very difficult for states to know what to do. Then secondly, you need to have regular phone calls at a very high political level with all of the states so that you can help them address the questions that are specific to their geographies. When we dealt with Ebola, we had SWAT teams, effectively health SWAT teams, that would go out to jurisdictions that had any concerns where there was an issue that their local doctors might not have either the information or the equipment they needed. And then you need to come up with sort of a way to pool resources so you don't have states fighting against one another for basic things like ventilators or masks or other protective equipment, which again, you're seeing that start to flare up in the U.S. now.
Chris, one of the things the United States has done, at least according to reports emerging today, is attempted to buy up the entire planet's stock of this particular drug, remdesivir, which is mighty neighborly of them. Does this strike you as a gesture driven by, you know, medical necessity or political expediency?
Well, I think it's any port in a storm, to be honest with you, Andrew. Remdesivir, made by Gilead, it was put out during the Ebola crisis and at that time didn't perform very well, got something of a rejuvenation with COVID because initial trials have suggested that it can reduce the duration of illness for perhaps a third, by about a third. So it knocks some time off the time at which you are feeling particularly unwell. It doesn't actually make a big dent in the mortality, though. So I don't think that this is necessarily money that well spent. It might be, as I say, a helping hand, but it's certainly not going to be a game changer, unless, of course, as more data emerges and maybe people know more than they've currently published. Maybe if given very early in the course of the disease, it might make a difference, and that might be why they're doing this.
Chris, I'll come back to Amy shortly with the potential political ramifications of this ban the EU has announced today on incoming Americans. But even with strictures like that in place, should the rest of the world be concerned about a massive upsurge in the United States? Because that's going to be very hard to contain within the US's borders, isn't it?
I mean, as the old saying goes, America sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. Here, America coughs coronavirus, and potentially you could spread it. The thing is, when you've got a country which has got a very high prevalence of the disease, so in other words, if you pick a person at random, there's a high likelihood that they're infected. If you move them to a jurisdiction or any part of the world where there's low prevalence, then you're adding a lot to a little, which means it's going to go up by a lot in that new area. You could spawn new cases. So that's why I think people are being very cautious. Most countries in the world, across Europe at the moment, have very low levels of circulation. The UK is one of the higher ones. So that's why most people are happy to see them coming from those countries to the UK, but not the other way around at the moment. But certainly if you've got outbreaks going on in the US, you don't want to be shipping people from high circulation areas to low circulation areas, because they will cause outbreaks.
And Amy, to come back to you with that just finally, even if there is a medical and scientific logic to hanging out the Americans' unwelcome sign at the EU's borders, and this is an absolutely extraordinary measure, not the kind of thing even a year ago you could possibly have imagined the circumstances that would bring this about, is it likely to register with most Americans, or are they more consumed by their own domestic news cycle?
Well, it's extraordinary, right? The U.S. has traditionally been able to access all sorts of countries, regardless of really even what's happening in the U.S., because the political ramifications of deciding not to admit them were too great. But in this case, we have a president who has shut down all travel from European countries, and he did that months and months ago. He shut down all legal immigration effectively. So if you were, for example, planning to travel to the U.S. to work there, you're no longer able to do so. So the U.S. has really effectively cut itself off from the rest of the world. And frankly, it shouldn't be so surprised that the rest of the world is now taking some reciprocal measures.
Amy and Chris, thank you both. That was Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith, and Chatham House's Amy Pope. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
As part of the programme's partnership with Allianz, we are bringing you stories that demonstrate Allianz's commitment to securing people's lives. After all, Allianz has been working hard to do just that, to give courage to its customers for what's ahead. Because Allianz knows how important it is to have a fair partner at your side. Stay tuned to The Briefing to hear exactly how Allianz does it. And Allianz for life.
Time now on The Briefing to get the latest business headlines. I'm joined to do exactly that from the City of London by Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, obviously the pandemic has been a huge, huge disaster for the global aviation business. The cost being counted, first of all, at Airbus.
And yes, we've discussed the job losses at airlines before. Now the crisis is feeding through to the plane makers. Airbus is embarking on the biggest restructuring in its history. It's cutting 15,000 jobs worldwide. About 10,000 will go across its main bases in Germany and France, but also job losses in the UK, in Spain and elsewhere. And what's worse, the CEO says that the job cuts are not the worst case scenario. He says Airbus's plan is based on the guess that domestic air travel picks up significantly by the end of 2020, and that long-haul traffic will have rebounded by summer 2021. Now, I don't think that is entirely certain, and he says that if that doesn't happen as predicted, he would have to revisit the plans. Now, he reckons that the company's output will be about 40% lower than expected over the next 2 years, and the industry slump could last as long as 5 years. So it's a pretty drastic message from Airbus, these job losses amounting to 11% of the plane maker's workforce.
Another related story, and you mentioned obviously that it was the airlines rather than the aircraft manufacturers that took the early hit, but they are still trying to figure out the way forward. EasyJet is going to close three UK bases.
Yeah, Europe's second biggest budget airline, EasyJet, is cutting about a third of its pilot positions and is likely to close three bases in the UK, including London's Stansted Airport. Now, EasyJet says it doesn't expect traffic to recover for another 3 years. It won't get back to the levels we saw in 2019 until 2022. That's EasyJet's best guess. The BALPA union, which represents pilots in the UK, says that the carrier has told it that it's going to cut about a third of the pilots employed. The company employs 2,300 pilots. We've already heard from British Airways and Ryanair. They're planning to let go of a combined 15,000 workers. It's quite interesting what the redundancies from the airline industry tells us about the economy. A lot of sectors, of course, currently protected by furloughing, and they're hoping that things bounce back as normal. We have some kind of V-shaped recovery later on this year, and things will just get back to normal. But the airlines are already saying, they've been saying for some weeks and months now, that things are not going to go back to normal, and they don't expect their business in 2020 or 2021 to look anything like it did last year. So pretty tough times to be in the airline business.
And just finally, Ewan, from Portugal, one possible suggestion for how struggling airlines might be carried through this.
Yeah, the Portuguese government is still hoping that private shareholders are going to accept a proposal on the conditions of a rescue loan for its flag carrier TAP. Now, the European Commission has already approved a 1.2 billion euro loan, but the private shareholders need to approve this. Now, if this doesn't happen, there is a report today that the Portuguese government could submit a decree to nationalise the flag carrier. The state already controls 50% of TAP, but this would be a fairly drastic measure. We've seen this right across Europe, of course, multi-billion euro bailouts from the German government for Lufthansa and from the Dutch government for KLM. But yeah, keep an eye on Portugal. We could be getting more news on that in the coming days.
Ewan Potts, thank you. As always, that was Ewan Potts at Bloomberg. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's show, we're going to wrap up the latest culture news with Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Ramella. Chiara, welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show, indeed. First of all, an expansive, indeed expansionist, gesture by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Sciences, in fact. Easy for me
indeed.
To say.
Indeed. Obviously, the Oscars have come under a lot of criticism over the past few years for lack of diversity and their problem with gender representation. And now the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has invited 819 new members to join its ranks. So that would bring, if everyone accepted the whole total, to over 9,000 people, actually. But this new invitation is aimed not only, but in particular, at trying to diversify its ranks in terms of both race and gender. If everyone did accept this invitation, it would bring the overall total of members to be 45% made up of women and 36% made up of underrepresented ethnic communities. So it would be obviously a welcome gesture. It is a welcome gesture, but we must not forget that this is a historical problem for the Oscars, and therefore it was, I guess, expected that some action would have to be taken in this respect.
I mean, yeah, it is obviously better than them not taking action in this respect, but do you get the sense they've been embarrassed into doing this?
I think the embarrassment began in 2016 when the Academy first pledged to double the amount of women that they had amongst their ranks by 2020, and similarly with issues of race also at the time. And in fairness, they have achieved those numbers that they had pledged. They have doubled those numbers. I think it's an issue of continuing to do so moving forward, because we have to remember that this has been happening in the ranks of the Academy. But you go back to the, for example, just the nominations for 2020, and we have to remember there was no female director nominated for the director's category in 2020, a real lack of black actors and actresses nominated in the categories. So this has to be a consistent effort across both nominations and the members of the Academy. I do welcome the fact that many people from many different sides of the industry, of course, will be joining the Academy. So it's not just the big profile actors and directors, but also, you know, the makeup artists, the execs, the producers, the visual effect coordinators. So long as this kind of comes as a industry-wide movement, then I think it's a positive thing looking forward.
Okay, well, let's take a look at another aspect of the world of the arts. I mean, art auctions have been possible to do remotely for some considerable time. People have always bid by telephone, but Sotheby's has gone entirely online.
Yes, well, this is a bit of an interesting experiment from Sotheby's. They've held their first kind of live-streamed evening auction, which was a bit of a combination of everything that you've just mentioned. There was telephone bidding, there was online bidding. Essentially, the auctioneer was on screen in London. Well, he was filmed in London whilst also connected to three different screens that were live streaming across from Hong Kong and New York as well. And it was a bit of a spectacle, and it lasted 4.5 hours, which is a long time to watch a stream, you know, for a viewer. Obviously, these auctions are always a bit of a spectacle when you do head in person. But I guess, you know, the idea of streaming something for 4.5 hours seems, you know, quite gargantuan. And the results, I think, interestingly, were quite positive. The sale totaled $363.2 million, which is not as much as the equivalent last year would have done in person in New York, but still a very high sum, considering obviously the pandemic has dampened the art market, predictably. But it looks like the fears regarding the upper end of the market just being particularly slowed down haven't materialized quite as much as people thought, and quite a lot of really, really high bidding, including, you know, millions and millions being bid online, which is quite a new thing because people had been quite reticent to bid such high sums online. Whilst obviously, I guess the pandemic has made people more comfortable or used to buying art online, and therefore we're seeing that in the auction format as well.
Finally, Chiara, and briskly, New Zealand has attracted many plaudits, obviously, for its handling of COVID-19. Is it possible it's now seeing an opportunity to get a head start, at least in terms of the film industry?
Yes. So the state has announced a package of $75 million New Zealand dollars to support its own homegrown film industry post-COVID. Now, this is interesting because the money will go towards funding 5 feature films or series filmed in New Zealand, and also to support certain productions that had to be delayed or shut down. I think New Zealand is obviously well known as a setting for many huge blockbuster films, and that's been also obviously a very important source of income for the state. But I think moving forward, because the state has been able to start its production earlier than other locations, it is in good stead moving forward to be the setting for even more big productions, but also because its own homegrown products, his own productions, will have a local audience, but potentially even a global audience too. You know, if other locations will not be able to produce quite at the same rate, and with the same health and safety protocols, with the same, I guess, optimism, then we might be in for a moment for New Zealand cinema to actually make its mark globally.
Chiara Ramella, thank you for joining us. That was Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Ramella, and that is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Chris Chermak, Rhys James, Yolene Goffin and Paige Reynolds. The researcher was Charlie Filmer-Court. Our studio manager was Nora Hewell. The Briefing returns at the same time tomorrow, midday London. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.